WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Reaction to the O.J. Simpson trial has shown that your view of America's criminal justice system may have something to do with whether you're white or black. A new study helps explain why. The study looks at young African Americans and the criminal justice system and analyzes why rates of incarceration are increasing dramatically. The study was released today by the Sentencing Project, an organization which conducts research on criminal justice issues and promotes sentencing reform. My guest Mark Maurer is the project's assistant director and the principal author of the study. The study found that an astonishing number of black men in their 20s is in prison, jail, on probation, or parole. It also found that African-American women have experienced the greatest percentage of increase in criminal justice supervision, but the number of women in prison is still relatively small compared to the number of men. I asked Mark Maurer to summarize his findings about black men in their 20s.
Well, we found some just dramatic findings. We find now that on any given day, one in three African-American males in the age group 20 to 29 is under some form of criminal justice supervision, either in prison or jail or on probation or parole. Now, this is an update from a study we did in 1990 that showed that nearly one in four young black men were under some type of criminal justice supervision at that time, which was certainly shocking enough. And yet, despite that, we've seen some dramatic increases in just this five-year period since then.
Did you do a breakdown on the kinds of crimes that the men are incarcerated or on probation or parole for?
What we found is that in recent years, drug policies, the whole thrust of the war on drugs, appears to be the most significant factor that's driving the increases in the prison population and criminal justice across the board. We see this in a variety of levels, doubling of drug arrests during the 1980s, much greater chance of going to prison upon conviction for a drug offense, the advent of mandatory sentencing, which not only makes it mandatory to send a drug offender to prison, but often for a very severe sentence, 5, 10, 20 mandatory years, as well as issues like the sentencing disparity between crack cocaine and cocaine powder and the racial implications that has had as well. While the absolute number of drug offenders has risen dramatically, the African-American proportion of those drug offenders has increased at a very disproportionate rate. A couple of quick examples. We know from surveys conducted by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which are considered the most comprehensive in the nation, that African-Americans represent roughly 13% of all monthly drug users. Now, there are some limitations to those surveys, and it's possible that African Americans are somewhat undercounted, but that's the base figure. When we look at arrests for drug possession, which presumably should be somewhat correlated with drug usage, we find that African Americans constitute 34% of all arrests for drug possession. And we go back to the 1980s, for drug offenses overall, blacks were 24% of drug arrests in 1980. Today, they're about 39% of all drug arrests. So a very substantial increase during this 10 or 15-year period.
You have found that now one in three African American men in their 20s are in prison or on probation or parole. Is this mostly violent crime we're looking at? Drug possession? Can you break down those numbers for us?
Yeah. Most of the men we're looking at here, and this is true across race and class and age group and sex, most of them are there for nonviolent offenses. Roughly one quarter of all the offenders under supervision have committed a violent offense. And, of course, they're disproportionately in prisons and the nonviolent offenders disproportionately on probation or parole. So for African-American males, as for other groups, about three quarters of them have been convicted of a nonviolent offense.
Well, you know, I think there are many different ways to interpret the statistics that you're giving us. And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, wow, the young African-American population is just breaking the law like crazy, and that's why so many of them are behind bars. You're saying that a lot of the alarming statistics that you're finding is because of the war on drugs hurting black men disproportionately. hurting the whole black population disproportionately.
Exactly. There's no question most of the people behind bars of any race or ethnicity have committed a crime. There is a relatively modest number of people who are probably innocent, but most people have committed a crime. The question is, how do we as a society respond to crime? How do we prevent crime? Now, if we know that drug usage cuts across class and racial lines, but enforcement of drug policies is targeted much more heavily to one type of community, one group of people, that calls into question whether this is a fair and equitable response. Yes, people may be possessing, using, selling drugs. Should we be focusing all our energies on one segment of the community at the expense of others? Now, I think the way that we approach it in other parts of the community, when middle-class people have a drug problem in the family, when their teenage son is clearly becoming addicted to drugs, they don't immediately call up the local prison system and reserve a prison cell for their son. Instead, they get out their insurance card and find the best drug treatment program that they can. When low-income people have a drug problem in the family, those treatment options are much less likely to be available, and it's much more likely that the problem will escalate into something that becomes a criminal justice system problem, results in a conviction and a likely incarceration down the road. So we end up having more or less a two-tiered system of responding to the same type of illegal behavior. One system says, let's treat this as a public health problem. The other one says, let's treat it as a criminal problem. And I think the numbers that we've documented tell us something about what these policies result in the long run.
Well, you also say that we have a two-tiered system of prosecution for whites and blacks.
Right. Well, we found and seen in a number of studies that have been documented, probably the most authoritative have been done by the United States Sentencing Commission and the Federal Judicial Center, looking at federal mandatory sentencing policies and federal drug policies in particular. The Sentencing Commission found that when you look at mandatory sentences for drug offenses, that whites were more likely to be allowed to plea bargain below the mandatory minimum than were blacks or Hispanics. Now, what we find there, I think, is that we don't know all the factors that go into plea bargaining, but we do know that mandatory sentences, while they sound mandatory on the surface, in fact, leave a fair amount of discretion to prosecutors. If I'm a prosecutor, I've got a drug charge against somebody, either the case I am presenting may be a little weak, or maybe there's some extenuating circumstances, and the prosecutors frequently will engage in plea bargaining. They kind of use the mandatory sentencing as the hammer to hold over the head of the defendant, but they will engage in plea bargaining. Now, for some set of reasons, the statistics tell us that they're more likely to engage in this type of plea bargaining when the offender is white. Now, are there legitimate reasons for this or not? I don't think we really know. The problem is, though, the impact of this is quite substantial. Since the mandatory penalties carry 5-10-year sentences, it's a very severe impact. When Congress first passed these mandatory laws, we were told, apparently, these are mandatory. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are, what resources you bring to the system. If you do the crime, you're going to do the time. In fact, that's not how it works out, and it's actually led to greater racial inequities than probably we'd seen before them.
You know, prison policies are a reaction to the growing number of people who are becoming involved with crime and the growing incarceration rate. But I think you're indicating you think that the get tough policies are actually part of the problem and, in your eyes, not a solution to the problem.
Well, clearly, there's a need for a prison system in virtually any society. We have a lot of crime in our society. We have a lot of violent crime, and it's quite a tragic situation. And prison is generally best used as a place to incarcerate people who present a serious threat of violence to the community. That's the most cost-effective, reasonable way to use prisons. continuing to escalate the use of prisons for people who are property offenders, nonviolent drug addiction people, is a much more questionable proposition when there are other options available. Now, if you look at the history of what we've done with our use of incarceration in this country, it's quite remarkable. For the past 20 years, we've been engaged nationally in what I think is really one of the greatest experiments in all of human history in using incarceration as a means of crime control. We have more than quadrupled the number of inmates in our prison system in just the last 20 years, to the point today where we have more than a million offenders behind bars. If we look at our local jails, there's an additional 500,000 there. So we've got 1.5 million Americans behind bars on any given day. Studies that we've done on international rates of incarceration show that the United States is now second only to Russia in the rate at which we incarcerate our citizens. Now, presumably, the point of all this is to have some type of impact on crime, because it's a very expensive thing and potentially very inhumane if it doesn't achieve some type of policy objective. Well, if we look at the impact on crime, I don't think we see anything terribly dramatic. You ask people on the street, very few people feel safer today than they did 20 years ago, despite the fact that we have four times as many people in prison. And in fact, if you look at crime rate trends in recent years, you'll find periods when the crime rate has gone up for several years and then gone down for several years. We don't see any consistent, strong relationship between incarceration and dramatically lowered levels of crime.
But I think if you ask most people if they'd feel more or less safe if people were just let out of prison who were in there now on drug offenses, people would say, oh, I'd feel less safe if all those people were let out.
Absolutely. If those were the only two choices, there's no question about it. If you're releasing drug-addicted criminals to the streets, it's going to present a threat to some of the rest of us. The problem is, I think, our national policy choices have tended to reflect only those two extremes. Either we lock them all up or we do nothing. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense, I think. We have a whole range of possible responses, starting, of course, on the front end with prevention and treatment. Nationally, our approach to drug policies has resulted in 2/3 of federal funding going to law enforcement, just 1/3 into prevention and treatment. It doesn't make a lot of sense, I don't think, to wait until the problem has exploded and deal with it at the back end rather than trying to address it up front. We also know that in communities around the country and in court system, judges and others are experimenting with a whole variety of alternatives to incarceration that allow nonviolent offenders primarily to be supervised in the community, to do community service work, to pay restitution to their victims, to get into treatment programs, to basically try to address the needs of victims, offenders, and the communities all at once, and generally doing it less cost than it costs to incarcerate somebody at $20,000 a year.
What are a couple of the policy recommendations your group is making?
I think much of the answer lies, of course, in long-term social and economic change. I think there's much we could do in the short run if we had the political will to do so. The most critical thing is to reverse the national policy on drugs and how we approach it, to put much more of our resources into prevention and treatment, deal with law enforcement on the back end for people who are the true drug kingpins of the drug trade. I think we also need to look for to eliminate mandatory sentencing and other overly restrictive policies that don't permit judges to make distinctions between a drug kingpin who's flying in drugs by the plane load and a college student who does a one-time drug sale to his or her friend. It doesn't make sense that the punishment should be the same for both of them.
My guest is Mark Maurer, and he's the principal author of a new report issued by the Sentencing Project, which is a group that conducts research into the criminal justice system and promotes sentencing reform. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Mark Maurer is my guest. He's the principal author of a new report by the Sentencing Project that has found that the number of black men in prison or on probation or parole, men in their 20s, is now 1 in 3. In your report, you quote the former police chief of Atlanta, Eldron Bell, who said that if nearly 1 in 3 young white men were under some form of criminal justice supervision, how would the nation react? Why is that an important question, do you think?
It is, because I think it suggests that if this report is viewed as just one more example of pathology in the black community, or why young blacks are criminals, or if it gets that type of response, I think it will have been done a great disservice. I think we always need to examine whether our national response does have a racial bias inherent in it when we talk about some of these deep-seated problems. And this problem is as severe as anything we face on a domestic level. We've saw it emerge in various ways in and outside of the O.J. Simpson trial. It's clearly indicative of a whole set of issues that are troubling much of the country. So I think we need to address it with the same type of attention that we would if it were any other group going through the system.
Now, do you think that your report on young black Americans and the criminal justice system has any application to helping us understand the apparent division between how African Americans and whites interpreted the O.J. Simpson verdict?
I think when we look at the history of race and criminal justice, this is a question that did not just start with the O.J. Simpson trial, but goes back 100 years. The history of lynchings in the South, the Mark Furmans of the Los Angeles Police Department, these are not new phenomena that have just developed in recent years. If we go back just 20 years or so, there were very few police departments, had many black officers. Certainly a black police chief was almost unheard of. And for a long time, the police were viewed with a good deal of suspicion and hostility in the black community because of widespread abuses that were perpetrated on people who had not necessarily committed crimes. I think black people also have recognized for a long time, perhaps not knowing the exact numbers that we've documented, that the criminal justice system, the prison system, was taking a massive toll on its young men in particular. Now, again, this doesn't mean that the African-American community is not concerned about crime. In fact, they're very concerned about it. But I think they have a very mixed response to the system. They want somebody to do something about the crime, but they also don't want to lose all their young men to the system, too. And so I think they bring with them this whole sense of frustration, hostility, almost oppression that they view historically the system has shown towards the black community, and that can help but get interpreted into things like the Simpson verdict and a number of other issues.
Did you see the Wall Street Journal yesterday?
No, I didn't.
There was an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal yesterday that said that race seems to be having a growing influence on juries, and that a lot of African Americans in the jury room are voting to fight what they perceive as a national crisis, a justice system that is skewed against them by the courts, the prosecutors, and racist police. Did you agree with that perception?
Well, I think it's very difficult, if not impossible, to actually measure anything like that. I think all of us, when we go into the jury room, are going in there bringing our personal experiences and histories and perceptions of the world. If those histories suggest that police have not always been honest or straightforward in our experiences, if it suggests that police might even lie, that prosecutors might manipulate evidence, a whole set of circumstances like that, then an individual juror, be he black or white, may be suspicious of police testimony. Now, is that good or bad? Well, I think we could argue that either way, but I think it says to us that black jurors, if they are less willing to convict, are not necessarily doing this because they want to let black criminals off, but it may be that they have a healthy and perhaps correct skepticism towards the official criminal justice system based on some very real experiences. And I think we need to pay some attention to that.
You have found a growing number of African-American young people who are under the supervision of the criminal justice system in prison, on probation or parole. What are your concerns about the impact this is going to have on the younger generation?
Well, I think the impact on the young men in the system already is clear and obvious. It's, you know, a time in life they'd be starting families and careers, and that's just not going to happen. I think the long-term consequences for black children growing up today, looking around them, and rather than seeing people in their 20s going off to colleges, getting married, starting careers, instead they see them in very huge numbers going off into the prison system. Well, for children growing up who are normally taught that if you work hard and play by the rules, there will be some rewards for you ahead, what kind of message is this saying to young black children growing up? I think this must be an extremely discouraging and overpowering message, and essentially saying it almost doesn't make a difference how hard you work and what you do. Sooner or later, you too will become enmeshed in the criminal justice system. And that's like just a time bomb ticking for the next generation unless we can do something about that.
Next on our show, we're going to be hearing from someone who founded a drug rehabilitation program within a prison. So he runs drug rehab programs within prisons. Is this something you recommend?
I think there's no question we need more of this in prisons and outside of prisons as well. And we have some good research evidence that shows us that a well-run treatment program in prison can be extremely cost-effective, can really have an impact on the drug problem. It's also not the sort of thing that you have to coerce inmates into doing. Many people recognize that they've reached bottom, as indicated by the fact that they're locked up in prison. And many prisoners are crying out for some help with their addiction. So I don't think we'd have any problem finding recruits for these programs if we had the funds available to make it much more accessible.
Well, Mark Maurer, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been good to be with you.
Mark Maurer is the assistant director of the Sentencing Project. Their study on young African Americans in the criminal justice system was released today. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.